This summer was a washout. For large parts of England and Northern Ireland, July was the wettest since records began. Flash floods have become commonplace and scorching temperatures normalised. Our climate is changing, and the population of the world is already on the move. Professor Neil Adjar, Professor of Human Geography at the University of Exeter, is the man at the coalface of all of this, who's been examining how climate change is increasingly forcing people to move and adapt for years. Climate change is no respecter of borders. It is a global, international issue. An effective analysis, and above all, a response, has to be international, and Neil's been doing just that. For example, he's been working in Bangladesh, exploring what makes certain cities climate resilient and some not. In the port city of Chittagong, he's found positive examples of city planning where planners have reached out to newly arrived migrant populations to integrate their needs into the changing cityscape. But it's not just physical changes that Neil has been studying. While climate disasters such as flooding can cause financial turmoil for a family, they can also wreak long-term psychological harm. His team at Exeter University have undertaken a long-term study of people living in the Somerset Levels to find out how their mental health was affected by persistent flooding. Climate change is now very real. Perhaps we can no longer return to the halcyon days when we were guaranteed some sunshine in July. But then, how can we adapt? With the answers is Professor Neil Adjar. And thanks for joining us on the We Society podcast.
Thank you indeed, Will, and thank you for that introduction.
Now, let's cut to the chase. You know, there are forecasts of 9 billion people on the planet by the middle of the century, 2 billion in Africa. We know that deserts are getting larger. How many people do you expect to move, or is movement just within a territory or jurisdiction? I mean, give us some sense of actually the magnitude of what's ahead of us.
First of all, let's say that, don't forget that 1 in 7 people, depending on how we define migration, 1 in 7 people on the planet have already moved during their lifetime. And so we've got to see this or recognize this.
Do you mean from town to country, or do you mean from country to country?
Within their own country, internationally. The stock of international migrants is about 3% of the world's population. At the minute, that's been fairly stable, despite a globalizing economy has been fairly stable for 30 or 40 years. It sort of moves up and down depending on open borders, you know, free movement, all sorts of issues. So I guess, first of all, let's, you know, recognize that people do move, and that movement has brought major social progress. Probably the single biggest number, if you put it together, of people moving is from rural China to urban China over the last 30 or 40 years. That's probably in the level of 200 million people just within a country. And that's been associated with that, you know, substantial, significant economic growth within that country.
And stress as well.
And stress, and the whole, and the movement towards a more urbanized world brings its own challenges. So you're absolutely right to point out that climate change, or implied in your question, climate change is going to be a big factor, cause huge stress on this growing population, and a population that will be increasingly urban. How many people will be moving because of climate change? A substantial number. Certainly some of the projections, even due to displacement because of weather-related extreme events, like you've mentioned, wildfire, floods, heat waves, over the next decade are quite substantial.
But give us a sense of 100 million, 500 million, less than that, more than that?
Probably in the 100 million range. That's certainly some of the World Bank's estimates and that sort of thing. But put that in the context of the underlying dominant flows of people, it may well amplify the flows of people, the migration flows that are actually going on at the minute. Only a relatively small proportion of which are international flows, i.e. across a jurisdictional border. But I think the key thing that we have found in our research, looking across all the evidence, that in some senses the problem isn't going to be too much migration, too much displacement because of climate change, but actually populations that are immobile, populations that are in effect trapped in place and don't have the capacity to move. Perhaps because of climate change, we would benefit from more movement, but actually we're not going to see that.
So if you take the most populous countries in the world, I mean, Brazil, Nigeria, China, India, Indonesia, what you're telling us is that people are moving within those countries, not really between them. That's the first point. And the second point is more people should probably be moving within those countries because they're trapped in areas that are flooding or areas that are too hot or areas that are becoming desert or whatever it might be. Is that your message?
That is pretty accurate description of the situation in many parts of the world. This is not an easy message, particularly for many governments. They look at their territories, they look at their cities, they look at their rural populations and have some ambivalence, let's say, towards growing cities, towards depopulation of rural areas. But many of these trends are ongoing and some of them will be amplified actually because of the impacts of climate change.
There's a double problem, isn't there? In your work, you identify the problem of people living in rural areas where there's either too much water or too little water. That's one problem. But another problem is actually they migrate to cities. And then you get, cities themselves are under stress because of climate change. Now, that, I think, is probably less understandable to our listeners. They probably get it that actually if there's a drought, that's a problem for a farmer, or a flood's a problem for a farmer. They probably don't get it that a city is a problem potentially as a result of climate change.
Well, I think if you've experienced 40 degrees in central London, maybe not this summer, but in other summers, you will begin to see
touché, it. You've got me.
And the infrastructure and the just the discomfort, the thermal discomfort that you feel because of that.
You can't sleep.
You can't sleep, which is why what a heatwave warning in the UK looks like. It's 5 days with a maximum temperature. It's different across the different regions of the UK, but a 28-degree maximum. But it's actually an 18-degree minimum for 5 consecutive nights because actually the diurnal range, the difference between daytime and nighttime temperatures, makes a huge difference in terms of thermal comfort. And people can't sleep. Their bodies get stressed physiologically. There's all sorts of impacts on it. So I think the urban experience of the risks of climate change are pretty visceral and experienced when we do. But actually the projections of those or the knowledge of what those risks are going to do are, you're right, probably underappreciated, let's say, certainly for various cities and probably for cities sort of universally or, throughout the world.
Now, I'm sitting in front of one of the, and we are listening to, I don't want to oversell you, but you are one of the world experts in this territory. You work in, associated with top people in Sweden, top people in Spain, you work in Bangladesh, you work in Ghana. What is the most vivid example of the kind of pressures you've been talking about?
I actually have had the privilege of working with Bangladeshi colleagues for 15 years now, and I have to say, what a country. What progress they have made since independence in 1971, just in terms of all the social development and economic indicators have gone forward. Back in the early 1970s, there was a huge cyclone with a death rate of, overall deaths that were probably not measured, but in the hundreds of thousands of people died because of a single cyclone in the early 1970s. That basically hasn't reoccurred. The country has progressed. The country has got its head around the issue of climate change. They have their own leading scientists, their own leading social scientists who've worked on this. And when people mention Bangladesh in many contexts around climate change, they don't mean the geography of that particular place or whatever. They use as a signifier as a place that is doomed in some senses. So people talk about the Ganges, Brahmaputra Delta, the southern part of it, the whole country is going to be underwater. But in fact, the population is stable in those areas, but the cities are growing massively. So the city of Dhaka, which was 2 million on independence, is now 15 million possibly at the last census. The city of Chittagong, Chattagram and the port city, was 1.5 million. It's now 5.5 million people in that time. So because of the growth in the manufacturing, the garment industry, probably some of the clothes we're sitting wearing at the minute. But those places are very exposed to the impacts of climate change. But their leadership, their their mayors, their, you know, just the planning, the engineers, their planning, the master plans for the future of those cities are now really taking on board the impacts of climate change to the region, the Bay of Bengal region and the rest of it.
But it's very vivid, isn't it? I mean, if the Himalayan ice cap starts to melt, I mean, the impact on the Ganges is going to be pretty considerable. I mean,
It is indeed.
It will flood and then shrink to a trickle. I mean, it's going to be a big deal.
There are a couple of really offsetting issues. The geomorphologists, if they're playing top trumps sitting of an evening, they will say, what's your favourite delta? And everyone's favourite delta is the Ganges-Brahmaputra because it's such an active system. There's basically so much of the Himalayas, so much sediment coming down those rivers that the islands, the low-lying Char Islands and the low-lying coast basically is able to rise and fall in geological time associated with sea level. So it's an amazing physical living system. One of the key issues for Bangladesh is actually the starvation of sediment coming down it because of upstream dams. So yeah, it's not too much water and sediment. It's actually too little sediment coming down because of dams being built principally in India and the Farak Barrage and the rest of it.
There's a similar kind of row, isn't there, in the Nile between Sudan and Egypt. I mean, it's kind of wherever you go, there's water issues. There's
classic water issues, yeah. Classic cooperation and cooperation systems that were set up when rainfall patterns were rather different and, you know, are now fluctuating. And so I think the consequence of climate change is manifest just to all these different scales through international cooperation on river basins down to how we experience it on the ground.
So when you see largely politicians of the right in Britain and America and other places, you know, saying, well, it's all a kind of socialist hoax, this climate change, it's forcing us to behave mm-hmm. as collectivists and deny us choice and all the rest. What's your reaction?
I was brought up on a farm. My parents and grandparents talked about the weather all the time. And they did recognise certainly my father later in life said, well, the climate has really changed. I've worked on these issues in sort of natural resources, agriculture, fisheries throughout the world. I've never met a farmer or I've never met, someone whose life and livelihood is invested in the climate who hasn't recognised the observed changes in the places where they have been. And that includes American farmers. And therefore, the cognitive dissonance of, I mean, not to be too partisan about it, but the cognitive dissonance of people saying there is no climate change, well, apart from the climate change that I'm experiencing as a rancher in the Midwest, is sort of leaves me somewhat cold.
I just want to take a moment to talk to you very briefly about the organisation behind the WE Society. The Academy of Social Sciences is a national body for academics, practitioners and learned societies in the social sciences. As the president of the Academy, I can tell you that we champion the vital role social sciences play in education, in government, in business, the list goes on. You can find out more about the Academy of Social Sciences work, support us, or read up on our fellows by going to the website acss.org.uk. That's acss.org.uk. Tell us what we should be covering, who we should be speaking to, by emailing wesociety@acss.org.uk. Now, back to the conversation. I want to get on to solutions and some of the work you've been doing and how you approach this. And this is kind of a bridge into that in a way. How do you persuade the skeptics and actually the population at large that it's worth their while belt tightening, recycling, paying extra, doing whatever is necessary to kind of mitigate climate change? I mean, how do we get, if you like, you know, the ordinary median man or woman to think, got to do something?
Unfortunately, some of my work does sound like it's in the field of climate catastrophes, the negative things that actually happen. And communicating that, in some senses, certainly through the temptation for this to be a narrative of crisis or a narrative of catastrophe or a negative fear, principally doesn't do it in terms of people's
motivation. Too much shroud waving puts people off, you mean?
Yeah, too, in terms of motivation for themselves, because the temptation is to put your head down and to, you know, look after yourself, and or to be fatalistic about it and say, well, it's happening and it's out with my control.
That's what everyone, I mean, you know, I'm just one person, you know, my flight, my recycling, you know, my having an electrical car isn't going to make much difference is a standard reaction.
Mm. But the other parts of this, I think, is to have people understand or to paint the picture that actually action on climate change, on decarbonising the economy, on mitigating climate change emissions is likely to be beneficial for many, many other reasons, and to, in some senses, sell or perhaps frame climate change as an issue of well-being, as an issue of health, as an issue of what sustainable living looks like. So we have made significant progress in the UK in decarbonising the electricity system, the generation of electricity, decarbonising that, taking the fossil fuel mix, you know, a little bit out of that. But the stubborn areas are on travel and transport, on residential use, and on food systems. And so in each of those areas, reframing those as what sustainable and healthy food looks like, what a neighbourhood looks like through active travel, through being safer, through the benefits of public transport, the benefits of infrastructure. I think the argument about climate change needs to be reframed down almost at that sectoral level to solve problems in people's lives, including insulation in people's houses for cold weather.
Give me an example of what you mean then. So you're going to reframe this. You're not going to be a finger-wagging politician or scientist. You're going to be a reframer. You're going to say, come with me on this journey. Give me an example of the proposition you'd like to make.
Let's go back to the issue of flood risk that you mentioned that I've been working on extensively.
Is the Somerset levels, yeah?
The Somerset levels are significant example in the UK, but there are many places like this and many parts of England and right across the UK that are exposed to floods. So if you go to places where the local community realises this, many of them are actually now acting together and saying, or in association with their local authorities, with the Environment Agency, and saying, what can we do to mitigate this flood risk to us? Because this is going to impact our houses, the value of our houses and the rest of it. But then going out and actually reducing, mitigating those floods through natural resource flood management, so bringing nature into it, actually reflooding floodplains where people may have been walked their dogs before, but actually allowing those to become more natural, rewilding, to, you know, working with farmers in the uplands. So these types of activities where communities are doing it for themselves or planning for their local environment for themselves are hugely popular, but also hugely effective at mitigating those flood risks. I'm thinking of the Culm River in Devon. The Taunton Sponge is a great example of a type of activity where the communities have got together and set aside some wetland areas so that the water accumulates, and rather than flooding through their, you know, down their streets.
That is an issue, isn't it? I mean, we have water is running off hillsides too quickly because it's being farmed or sheep farmed or whatever and not being soaked up. And then it washes into your living room if you're downstream, and suddenly, you know, your television is floating about in front of you and you retreat upstairs. I mean, it's all quite vivid if you're in that situation. And so you do collectively act. That's a very dramatic example. I mean, just before we leave it, I mean, what are the psychological impact? I mean, the Somerset levels is what? It's some hundreds of square miles, isn't it? And what are they? I mean, 10,000 people live there, maybe a little more? I mean, yeah.
Yes, double that across, you know, two district council areas, really.
So it's a big number.
Yes.
And give us a sense of what happens to people, because this was one of your levers you pull, is that people's well-being, their psychological well-being, their happiness, you know, is closely linked to how secure they feel about managing flood risk.
If you remember back to, now, 10 years ago, it was the winter of 2013-14, against Somerset.
The worst
levels,
floods forever, weren't they?
The worst floods on record in 175 years of rainfall records in most parts of the country. It was basically long and enduring floods, and parts of Somerset, and which is why it's become very visual to us and we remember it, were underwater for months. The various parts of the health research community realised that the impact of this was not necessarily going to show up in the health services and demand for them. But they went out with a very large-scale cohort study across places that were flooded across England, including Somerset, but also East Anglia, Lincolnshire, Kent and various places. And they determined that actually the risk of mental ill health, anxiety, stress, post-traumatic stress disorder was elevated 5 to 7 times in those individual households where people were actually flooded, relative to places.
Hardly surprised, really. I mean,
relative to the places next door to them.
Yeah. No,
Part of our research then was to work out why, and it was basically it's people's idea of their disrupted futures, of you know their security, their place that they thought they were going to have forever. It's to do with the violation of home. People are very invested in their place and their home. People who were very distressed about their pets, about personal possessions and that, and those sorts of things. And also then the aftermath of dealing with floods, which was to do with insurance, you know, loss adjusters, feeling alone. These are the sort of mechanisms that actually turn this trauma into actually a significant negative impact on well-being and on mental ill health. But what we also found at the same time was people said to us in Langport and in various villages in Somerset, this was the worst thing that has ever happened to us, but it was the best time I ever had. So they, when it was the community actually acted together and came together, quite often facilitated by the Somerset County, you know, level mental health teams and the rest of it, to actually encourage people, each other, to help each other. There was no other, you know, opportunity. People got to know their neighbours. And so, quite a lot of that negative consequence was offset by this sort of collective action and communities coming together, in this case, in solidarity. But that does last into the future. And so I think, you know, looking at people's attachment to place, their, you know, ideas of identity and what place means to them, is one way into talking about how climate change is going to affect them, because there are things that people care about over and above the economic consequence, which is themselves, that their own health, the health of their family, the place that gives meaning to their lives, and those sorts of things.
You're on these various kind of, you advise the Swedes, you advise the Spanish, I mean, you're on the committee of the climate change panel. What problems do they come to you with? And tell us about a solution that you're proudest of.
There might be even a sort of divergence between those two parts of the questions. Both the UK, through the climate change risk assessment undertaken by the Climate Change Committee, the UN panel that I've been involved in and impacts, the UN Intergovernmental Panel on Climate Change, they've all been motivated by these big and scary things. The Intergovernmental Panel on Climate Change was co-awarded the Nobel Peace Prize in 2007, along with Al Gore. And they determined at that time that they hadn't really looked at the risk of climate change to peace and the potential for conflict around that. And so I was charged, part of the team that actually did that assessment in the subsequent cycle of the IPCC reports looking at the issue of human security. The evidence that, or the likelihood...
What did you spot? What did you warn of?
The likelihood of interstate wars, i.e. wars between countries over water resources, whatever, is at the minute vanishingly small. But there's, that doesn't mean to say that there isn't major conflicts and rivalries, particularly over food and food resources going forward.
So people aren't going to war over water. That's an important thing to know. They're collaborating, they're cooperating, they're finding a way through.
That even those basins, those 60 or so major basins in the world where water flows between countries and there has been not a violent conflict, but certainly been rivalry and disagreements and political tensions between those countries, in most of those, there is a mechanism by which these will be resolved. But the knowledge of how climate change is going to affect those is really, really critical to put that on an even footing. The other issue that we looked at in terms of human security was this issue of migration. And again, a framing of it popularly that climate change is going to lead to displacement, mass displacement of people moving across international borders, where that is not a significant likelihood because the mass movement of people is still within jurisdictions, within big countries, and particularly to rural to urban. What am I most proud of, I would say, is going back to one particular place, and this is really what social science does, look at the context of how these things happen in place and how these actually work in practice, is southern Bangladesh. The population of southern Bangladesh has, in effect, stabilised. The last two or three censuses have showed that the population densities aren't changing. They're actually below replacement fertility levels, so it's a stable population. But there's now significant outflows of people to the cities. But when people move to a city, the port city of Chittagong, they're actually faced with a whole set of environmental risks, a whole set of climate change risks associated with flooding, with public health, with lack of access to public services. And so what we did on the ground was to say that actually the sustainability of this growth of those sorts of cities, somewhat amplified by climate change, but certainly with these new climate change risks, is going to be that their sustainability is really tied up with how quickly and how effectively the new populations moving into the city, who are most at risk because where they live, basically in slum areas or in high-density neighbourhoods and quite often with low-income jobs, how quickly and how effectively their voice is heard, how that's taken in, on board with the development of the city. Because in a city that is growing, that its population has quadrupled in probably 40 years, then many, many people continue to arrive, continue to grow, and those are people who are really excluded from this and where all the vulnerability lies. So what we did was worked with the planners there and worked with migrant communities and actually brought them together using various methods. And the planners then, who build the infrastructure, who plan, who develop the master plans, then were extraordinarily appreciative of these new voices, of new migrant voices, of the lived experience of what it feels like to be in the city and how these very specific risks could actually be tackled.
You're getting a conversation going between representatives of these people and the city planners to do precisely what? Build more sewers, to build more pumps in the street for clean water, when you say you heard their voices.
What are the practical solutions?
Yeah, what's practically happening?
The practical solutions are about the provision of water, about the provision of toilets, for example, which is a huge issue just in terms in very low-income neighbourhoods where there are shared resources. They also, the provision of public space for local entrepreneurs, for markets to grow, these sorts of issues. And also the regulation of the housing markets, because one of the stepping stones for social mobility is to clearly move out of slum areas into others, but it's the regulation of those, and this is the same in every city globally, the regulation of housing markets, of landlords and their actions. So there are both social and environmental dimensions to this risky landscape that people are moving into, and economic dimensions. And so some very good practical solutions coming out of this, basically in the realm of public health, but also in the realm of economic opportunities and minimising discrimination in labour markets and all sorts of areas.
To what extent does your work overlap with, you know, the well-being movement? I mean, I Professor Richard Layard and others have got the, you know, campaigning to promote world well-being and saying that this is the only yardstick really for public policy. Does it promote, you know, more well-being than there was before? If it doesn't, then you shouldn't do it. I mean, are you ploughing an independent furrow from their work, or do you know of their work? Do you bring it together? I mean, how? Just to give a sense of, you know, what's the community in which you work? What levers are being pulled by whom to make things better?
The great thing about that work on well-being is that it does focus on those mechanisms by which people's lives are made real or people's lives are made meaningful. But it tends to focus on the individual aspects of that. One contribution to that really comes from human geography, but many other social psychology and other areas at the interface of where I'm working, which is the idea of community resilience and the idea of collective well-being and the way that place and identity contributes to an overall sense of well-being and those sorts of elements.
I'm proud of where I live. I was born here. I work here. My kith and kin have been part of it for so many years, and now I'm watching it be endangered by whatever it might be, but an environmental or climate change phenomena. And that hurts me. And I want to act with colleagues in my community to kind of try and prevent the pace of that happening. That's the process you're describing, is it? I mean,
it is.
Just give us a string of places where, you know, people can kind of anchor their response to this, where, you know, where that's actually happening. So it's not kind of ethereal, broad brush, but actually really concrete, vivid for people.
In all the places I've worked, I've observed this. Another way to express this is this idea around human security, which in the vernacular means freedom from want and freedom from fear. And the impact of climate change really sort of speaks to this, the consequences, risks and fears that people have. And I've observed this in work that we've, with collaborators that I've worked with in Australia, where the in northern Queensland, the Great Barrier Reef, all the communities around there, we showed this in survey work, they've got a very strong sense of identity and pride in the Great Barrier Reef, this World Heritage Site that sits on their doorstep. But actually, that well-being was diminished because of major coral bleaching effects and these periodic, which
is
come along.
It is amazing, isn't it? The world of 50 years ago when the coral was multicoloured and now it's just bleached.
Periodically it is, and that stress and risk is increasing because of El Nino events, and those are becoming stronger. And so there's serious concerns about the future of coral reefs. So from communities in northern Australia that take pride in the reef and place and identity, through to communities in Lincolnshire and Somerset, through to farmers that we've talked to in southern Ghana and the fishing communities there, I think these issues are common throughout the world and universal. And I think that's one of the great strengths of social science, to sort of cut through and see these patterns in meaning. And then to try to turn that into positive action over and above the empowerment of social science in bringing these voices to the table.
Just to conclude, I mean, Greg Clark was talking to us on an earlier podcast about kind of optimal city size and that actually the future is the city and celebrating the city. I mean, half the world's population now live in cities. But you're kind of taking us in a slightly different direction. You're saying, oh, that's fine, it's going to carry on happening, but we've got to build climatically resilient cities. Mm. What do you look for?
The great news is that many of the progressive cities in the world have this in mind. They are understanding this. Both the, for example, the C40 group of mayors. There is another organization, a spin-off organization called the Mayors Migration Council, that have looked at the principles of how people are moving to the cities and how to integrate.
You live in an amazing world, Neil. You know, kind of lots of morphologists and geographers talking about deltas and the whole community looking into the world's deltas. And now you've got the group of 40 progressive mayors. I mean, it's a completely, it's a world in which I know not much. And I'm guessing that not many people listening to this know much. I mean,
in some senses, this is hugely, well, I'm not surprised, but for the listeners, I think it is reassuring that anyone who looks at the evidence has realized that climate change is coming down the track is going to be very, very significant for the economic geography of the world, of where people live, what they do, the economic activities. And whenever there are extreme events, heat waves, floods and the rest of it, we see disruption to economic activity. We see insurance companies not wanting to insure houses, disinvestment in places. We can see that changing economic geography, but it's happening at a very scale that perhaps is outwith or, you know, sort of a day-to-day experience of it. But be assured that the social scientists and the engineers and the environmental and climate scientists are doing absolutely everything we can to make sure that this information is there and allows us to help build those climate resilient cities for the future and climate resilient societies more generally.
Neil, it's been a fascinating conversation, and you've taken us on a kind of world tour. You've taken us from the Somerset Levels and people distressed about their homes being ruined. You've taken us to Chittagong in Bangladesh, how to deal with the slums of the millions arriving into this booming city have got to be managed, the dialogue between the city planners. You've taken us to Ghana, you've explored the world of deltas with us, and you've alerted us actually to a bunch of problems in which, encouragingly, you're saying that mayors and geographers and social scientists can't prevent climate change, but are finding a language that may make populations own that there's a difficulty and give permission for governments to respond and leaders of cities to respond. And it's encouraging that you say that. It's encouraging that you move in this community, which is doing kind of good stuff. And I think I leave the studio rather more confident and upbeat than when I arrived in it. So thank you very much.
That was absolutely my intention, Will, to, you know, present a positive story around this, because it's on the cards, it's coming our way, and we have got to use this as an opportunity to create a wee society.
Nilaja, thank you very much. The Wee Society is brought to you by the Academy of Social Sciences. Find out more about the Society by going to www.acss.org.uk. I'm Will Hutton. The producer is Emily Finch, and it's a Whistledown production. If you haven't already, please subscribe to the podcast so you're the first to know when a new episode comes out.